All right.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us today. So for the month of February, Teen Health Source is going to be posting and hosting content related to Black history. And that includes articles, podcast episodes, artist features, and resource highlights. And so many of the things that we talk about on Teen Health Source, from sexual health service access and reproductive justice to mental health and relationships, are all navigated differently depending on who you ask. We know that our experiences are shaped by all of the different elements of who we are, including race. And so we actually wanted to take this opportunity to dive into the ways that Blackness in particular shapes these experiences. So today we are joined by our lovely friend, Paula. So Paula, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself, talk a little bit about the program that you work for, and maybe what we'll be talking about today.
Hi, thank you so much, Stuart. My name is Paula. I work for the TEACH programs, Teens Educating Against Homophobia. Oh my God, did I say that right? Teens Educating and Confronting Homophobia. That's
there you
it.
Go. Sorry. Confrontation is a key part.
Yes. I've been working for the program for a little while now, and it has been such a great experience. So today I wanted to cover like the intersects of being Black and being queer and how that informs our lived reality and the different ways that it shows up.
Right. And that's something that we're also especially talking about for Black History Month, because we do know that these experiences are pretty unique and that there's a very storied history about this stuff too, right? Like it goes back for like a really, really long time, especially in places like Canada, where maybe sometimes we don't necessarily associate Blackness with like a Canadian identity or anything like that. So because of that, I did want to dive into this history a little bit. And I actually wondered if you knew about any like Black queer figures in history that you maybe wanted to talk about today?
Yeah, so I have two favorites personally, and they're pretty well known. So James Baldwin is an amazing writer who grew up mainly in America, but has like national writings and has traveled the world and was very open about his queerness while still fighting for racial equity for the Black community. And through his writings, you can see the way that like the dynamic of race and queerness come into conflict, and the way that they sometimes complement each other and create tight-knit communities who live on like the intersection of these two very people view as polarizing identities.
Right. Okay. So can you talk a little bit about what you mean by polarizing identities?
So like in mainstream media and like just like mainstream social idea, when you think of like Blackness, you think of usually heterosexual men. And when you think of like queerness, you typically think of like white men. Like when you think of like gay, you typically think of white men. So in people's mind, that those two identities of being queer and being Black can exist in one person is sometimes off-putting. You'll hear some people say like Black people can't be queer, like that's a white thing. Or you'll hear like queer people be like, we shouldn't care about race, it's about like our sexuality and the rights that we have been restricted from, or the way that it impacts us in our social lives. And it's like those two issues exist and harm and oppress like one person as they live on that intersect.
Right. Okay. So that would be why we would highlight this specific issue today. And you said there was a second person that was also one of your faves?
Yeah, Audre Lorde. Audre Lorde love her. Sister Outsider was like a top tier novel for me, and it's a whole bunch of essays of just her experience of living, but speaking about the different ways that her race presented itself in different countries, the way that her sexuality presented itself in her work, in her academic writings, in her life, through having a partner and having kids and living in the Black community for safety and comfort, and how being queer actually helped her have a unique view of like womanist and like Black women-centered ideas and ideas of liberation. So she was absolutely an amazing figure. I clung onto like really, really, I clung onto like a lot in university.
Yeah, no, she's an incredible author, and she's done a lot of like activist work too. I know she did a lot of work in like Berlin in the 80s, where she talked about helping people find this idea of being like a Black person in a non-Black nation or something like that too. Like she really helped build these communities in places where it was maybe a little bit difficult to do that too, right?
Yeah, 100%. She traveled and did speeches in Moscow, Russia. She's been a really big world traveler, but like her work in feminist writing and womanist like literature has been absolutely breathtaking. Like the more that it ages, the more relevant it becomes, which is crazy, but amazing at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, sad that like, you know, she was so big in like the 70s and 80s, and the conversations really haven't changed much from the same sort of issues that people were talking about back then.
Yeah.
So with figures like Audre Lorde, with figures like James Baldwin, I mean, they become these big figureheads. They do all of this writing that is kind of taken up by like the people at large, right? Like the people from the communities that they represent. And then these things sort of turn into movements, or they kind of complement the social movements as well. Can you think of anything, any of these like social movements that have maybe been pushed or started by Black queer people?
Yeah, so James Baldwin was really big in like Black equity and like liberating communities, about addressing police violence in like the 70s, and basically just the understanding of like humanizing Black people instead of thinking of them as like a monolith or an other that's just like not really investigated in a way that brings their humanity. Like they have different ideas, they have different sexualities, they have different ideas of what liberation looks like. And even like in modern day right now, it's very popular for like the Black Lives Matter movement, and a lot of people believe it started organically, as it did, but the key organizers were two Black queer people and then two Black women, and they were the ones who built the organization. They were the ones who put forward organizing strategies, gave people location, created maps and chapters around the world. There are Black Lives Matter chapters in almost everywhere. And that's typically where I push people. If you want to donate to that cause specifically, you should donate to the local chapters, as I think they have the most local impact compared to the national organization.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, looking like through history too, it does seem to be that these like key figures in all of this organizational effort, like they tend to be queer people, they tend to be like Black women especially, and we don't really like see them, like you kind of said, we don't really see them as the faces of the movement or the people who are really behind all of those like efforts.
And there's even Bayard Rustin that a lot of people overlook, but he was very openly queer, and he was a key advisor to MLK Jr.'s protests for integration, movements, different speeches. He was a co-writer on them, and he was a very important figure that kind of gets pushed to the background compared to, of course, MLK was the leader, but like other organizers around it, and just being a part of this and being shown to be a key player in community advocacy.
Right. Yeah. And when we say MLK, obviously we're referring to Martin Luther King Jr. Yes. For folks who might not know the acronym.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. Yeah. Okay. So why is it that we think that it might be that we're kind of like pushing the queerness down, or we're not talking about it as much with some of these movements? Like, why do you think that might be?
I think it's easier. Like people want a very especially when they're fighting against like typically normal societal issues.
Normal in big scare quotes.
Exactly. I like to say normative, so like what we believe is normal. Right. And it's a lot easier like for the queer movement, though. Like we don't know who actually started the riots that caused like the huge protests that have been going on still till this day, but a lot of people attribute it to Black lesbians, Black trans people who were key pushers, key fighters constantly at the protests, constantly at the marches, constantly organizing for different organizations. But a lot of the face of the queer movements for marriage liberation, for gender equity, for just the ability to exist without violence being put upon us, has been like white cis people. Where right. It's easier to accept them and say, oh, I can see you, like the quote unquote normative society, like the larger society, I'll say. They're like, right. Oh, I can see you as a sister or a brother, or, oh, my cousin is gay. Like, wow, I see it. But if they were to be faced with the fact that, oh, not only am I gay, but I'm also Black, it would be personally, from what I've read and what I've seen and history, like it would be a bigger fight and it would be a lot less palatable.
Right.
And this is like the same personally for the racial liberation movements, where it's a lot easier to be like, hey, we just want to have our white picket fence families too. Like, can you stop racially terrorizing us? Like, can we all be like treated as human beings? And it's a lot harder to be like, not only am I a Black person who wants to be treated as a human being, I want you to accept and not discriminate against my sexuality and how I decide to partner or live my life, really. So people are really easy at taking one message if they can like humanize you in a way that they view human.
Mm-hmm.
And they're more likely to ostracize you for the other. So it's a lot right. easier to put these simpler faces that only have this one little quote unquote flaw, and make space for them instead of having to actually engage with and address like the different identities that people have that make them unique, but less relatable to yourself.
Yeah, because that's the thing, right? Is like, when we talk about these movements, we want them to be complicated. I mean, we can have the slogans, and those are really helpful too. But sometimes if we're only forwarding, or we're only talking about like one particular issue, if we're only talking about Blackness, if we're only talking about queerness, like we kind of lose a little bit of the community there. Like the needs of the entire community aren't always represented when we talk about like one singular issue. Like it has to be a little bit more complicated, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you keep talking about this word like intersecting, which I think is like a really important thing to kind of dive into a little bit. Because when we talk about like these different parts of what makes a person, these different parts of an identity, we're thinking about like your race, we're thinking about your gender, we're thinking about your sexuality, and how those all sort of impact the way that you go through life, right? The way that, like, how easy it is to find work and whether or not you have rights to get married or like a childcare adoption, all that stuff. So why is it that maybe these like identities, why do they feel so political? And maybe also, could you talk a little bit about what we mean when we say that the different kinds of identity, being Black, being queer, what it means when we call those things political?
Yeah. So it's, like, as you said, it's the being like it goes even as far as like gender expression, like the way that you express your masculinity or the way you express your femininity or just your gender identity in general. Those things can also feed into how you experience like masculinity, gender identity, femininity. And they feel political because as you exist, people are constantly debating about your existence. There are laws put in place to further oppress you, to relieve former oppression that's been historically implemented, to like even, I think it's in New York, like there are several states still, but in New York, they had to pass a Crown Act because Black people in general, but Black women specifically were being discriminated against for how they just kept their hair. And there has never been a law in that I know that was nationwide that needed to be implemented to not discriminate against white people and how they keep their hair. So as we talk about it, the mainstream issue around queerness was marriage, still is in some places, but the idea that your relationship is not valid under law, that your partner cannot engage with you in a hospital because they're not considered family, that if that person passes away, that you won't be able to deal with their final rights or inherit the things that you have both owned together, is living politically. Just the fact that you're in a relationship previously wasn't allowed. So this is even more when you add in race, where it's like, not only can you not be in a relationship with the person you want to be with, you also can't get a job in this field because as it was thought previously, Black people don't have the intellect for this. Oh, you can't have a home in this area because you don't fit the character of the neighborhood, which meant you weren't white. Right. And you couldn't even go to certain schools. So as you like exist, people are making laws and policies that you have to fight against in your personal lives, talking to people, engaging with people, explaining to them why you deserve to be treated like a human being. And mm-hmm. at the same time, you have to fight like government forces and local forces, because some of these rules were very informal. Like no law was actually passed to enforce like certain racial rules and queer rules. It was just a normal idea that we don't do this. Normal people don't do this. And if you do this, you're abnormal and you lose your humanity.
Right. So when we talk about this idea of being political, it's not like we're talking about, you know, debating with politicians, although that absolutely does happen, but just for like the everyday person, like you are kind of forced into being a political person just by how you live your life. Being able to access things, like you said, like marriage, like a job, those are political issues. People vote on those issues. People write about those issues when it comes to like law and legislation and that sort of thing, right? So
exactly. And you don't get the option. Like that's the key part of these identities being political, is you don't get the option to not engage with them because they affect your life. Like white cis straight people cannot engage with politics because unless it directly affects their lives, they can just coast on it. While the identity being Black and being queer, and the identity being Black and queer, like you are constantly going up into political debates for your existence, for mm-hmm. these access to these services. So you don't have the option of being like, I just don't want to deal with it because it will affect you.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's such an important thing too, with what you were saying about, you know, there might not be a law that says that like Black people can't access reproductive care in Toronto, right? But we know that through all sorts of issues that are social, that are the way that like neighborhoods are kind of like mapped out, that it can be a lot more difficult for like a Black person to access like reproductive care. It's not, again, it's not written into law, but because there's so many different factors that play into like how somebody can access services, we know that it ends up being a thing.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's kind of what we're talking about when we talk about that, like that, how it comes up in your everyday life. Like that's sort of where it comes from. So, I mean, these conversations too, like you said that obviously when it comes to like white cis people, like there's the ability to turn away from all of these issues. But of course, like we're still seeing a lot of these issues being talked about in mainstream media. You know, we have shows where because I feel like when we talk about media too, we're looking mostly at like television and film. And there's always a push for more inclusivity, to include more identities, to include more diversity. And so there are like a few things that talk about like Blackness and queerness, right? Are there any that you can sort of think of that are really like centering that conversation right now?
Yeah. So I finished, it took me a while because I was so sad it was done, but I really enjoyed Pose. Pose is I don't want to call it a mockumentary. It's basically a stylized version of what ball culture was and what it meant to Black queer people, Black trans people, Black poor people, and how it was a place of community when the white queer community didn't want them because they thought that they made the movement look bad, and the Black community rejected them, as there was like a very huge culture generally of just homophobia, transphobia, biphobia, just like queer panic in general. So a lot of these people were being displaced from their homes. They were not being allowed to get jobs, and they were able to like make families and communities in the ball culture. And there's this historical sense of like mothers and fathers of the house, because you have to make your own community. You have to make your own community, you have to make your own family of people who genuinely and love and accept you for who you actually are. So right. Pose was like amazing for that.
So to talk a little bit about like what is ball culture? I've heard it called ballroom culture. I've heard it called ball culture. Like, what is that when we're talking about ballroom? What are we talking about?
So basically ballroom is like a dance show, but it's like a dance show pageantry. That's the best way to say it. So in downtown New York in the late 60s, 70s era, a whole bunch of Black, trans, queer people came together and they started to do like dance competitions, showing off like the weird poses they had seen in Vogue magazines, like how the models would do it, and they would create it to dances, and there would be MCs where there's actually no music. It is a form of music, but it isn't structured music. So they weren't just playing like Madonna and voguing to it. They were, which she actually took that from ball culture, but side discussion.
That's episode two.
Exactly. But yeah, so people would like follow a beat. So the MC would like make a beat. So they're doing beats and they're like spitting off the cuff. And if you've ever heard like Katrina, the hurricane, that's it. Like that is pure ball culture.
Right. And so these, yeah, sorry, continue.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to be like, so they're like dance competitions. You said they're also like houses.
Mm-hmm. So they'll compete against each other. And that was a real big thing of like keeping the community nonviolent, because there was a lot of violence externally from the larger society against these communities. So to not stop infighting, but at least deal with conflict, they would say like, let's bring it to the balls. So my right. house is going to go up against your house, and I hate you because of this, and I don't like you because of this. So I'm going to vogue my ass off, and I'm going to show you that I'm better than you. So right. it was ability to have community. So these houses, just like, you know, in larger society, is where your family is, where your mom is, where your sister is, where your cousins are. And they would come up with names that glorify themselves. And a big part of it was competition in the sense of who can show like femme realness for like typically the trans girls who outside of this community would not have their identity of woman or femininity validated. So mm-hmm. they would exist in this place where they could participate, and there were jokes of jest, and some of the MCs weren't nice, but you could at least present yourself as feminine and be accepted as a woman in these communities. And there would be like military realness, like heiress, bougie, you know, old money. And you could be that there in the way that larger society wouldn't let you be that outside. And people focus on these areas, but there was also mutual aid, where when someone needed a job, if somebody who is like trans needed a job, they could talk to their other friend who has a job and maybe get a job in that area. If you were gay, you can get a job in this area. Like my friend got a job here, my friend got a job here, and different resources for like if they had to participate in sex work, like who's good, who's bad, what areas are okay, and resources, like specifically on transitioning, because transitioning back in that time was really hard. You had mm-hmm. to, you couldn't just go to a doctor and get HRT or estrogen. Like you had to go to a street dealer. So people would typically try it out on themselves, see if it works, and then they would give that resource to other people. And that was a way of community resource sharing and mutual aid and giving housing. Like I have a house and you can stay here while you have been displaced from your like other house. Like just being able to actually like exist and give each other the support that like the larger society was not willing to give them.
Right. And I know too, because especially like ballroom was so big in like the 80s and the 90s, right at the height of the AIDS epidemic, like a lot of like that end of life care was really like looked after by like the members of ballroom and like the ballroom community, finding like medication, you know. We often say too that like safer sex as a movement was like started by these sort of queer communities in these places too. So I feel like mm-hmm. a lot of that information was sort of circulated around at that time.
Yeah. And advocacy work, because mm-hmm. As a lot of like queer men were dying, like lesbians would show up from these different areas to donate blood, because gay men were not allowed to donate blood for oppressive reasons. But there would be advocacies around like, hey, please donate blood, around like giving money for funerals and family services, for claiming bodies that families wouldn't claim. It was a really big thing, especially in the like speak up. There was a huge amount of Black queer people, Black trans people, who were very active in doing the groundwork specifically for Black queer people who were affected by the AIDS crisis.
Right. And I think that's another thing too, where if you look at the history of like AIDS activism, the faces you're going to see are these like gay, cis, white men living in these like urban centers like New York, like San Francisco. And we really do sort of forget that so much of that work was being done by like Black trans people as well, who were kind of, like you said, like excluded from these narratives, the way that we look at these histories and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So we talk about ballroom as originating in like the late 60s and 70s, but we know too, obviously with the show like Pose, it is kind of looking back on those histories, but ballroom is very much still here, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, 100%. It has actually become fairly mainstream in like the queer culture and like community. So drag shows have always been around. They were viewed as more of a white gay situation, and even they faced a lot of hardships through that. But like shows like RuPaul's Drag Race take heavily from ball culture and mm-hmm. RuPaul himself. But yeah, there's a whole bunch of shows like legendary now. I wish they had more ballroom judges, but I don't produce the show. And it's even become like worldwide, where different cultures, countries have their own ballroom, which include like different people. There is a bit of like an erasure that I have been seeing, where it's like, oh, this is just like queer culture, and it's like, yeah, it's Black queer culture and you're allowed to participate in it, like I can't stop anybody. But the acknowledgement is where the issue comes in, where people are like, oh, but we can just do it. And I'm like, that's fine, but you need to acknowledge the people who were raided when they were doing ball culture, who mm-hmm. were like not able to because they walked down the street in a dress and they didn't make it to the ball.
Right.
And
so there are these, yeah, very, very particular histories of like who was actually affected by the oppression that we were kind of talking about here. And it is mostly, like you said, it is mostly the most like visibly othered people. So it is Black, queer, trans people especially.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, we're like, at least personally, I'm happy that it's becoming more mainstream. I'm happy that people are willing to engage with it and are enjoying it. It's, we have to honor the people that came before us, because if we don't, we're just gonna think, oh, this is just a thing and now we can all just do it. And it's like, no, like people really worked to make this thing that is amazing, that is mm-hmm. awesome, that is like life-giving personally.
Yeah. Well, and you talk about humanizing, right? Like you talk about like, and part of humanizing a person is recognizing that like there is value in their life, and you know, obviously like ballroom is, like you said, it had become mainstream. It's influenced the way that like the queer community talks. And I mean, there's the whole joke of like, what is it, like the white girls take from like the white gays and then the white gays take from like the Black girls. And then it is all sort of circulating too within this like queer community and the way that we all sort of speak to one another, like the Yas Queen, et cetera. Like we know that that's like a bit dated, but that specifically all those sorts of terms, those ways of talking, they're not like invented by white gays. That's not where they come from.
Yeah. It's like it trickles up and then all of a sudden it's just generally palatable. And it's like, no, there are people who were very much marginalized for existing in that, speaking like that. Mm-hmm. And the ballroom, which I really appreciate, was a place where you could just exist, where if you told people that I am a woman and I want to be referred to as a woman, you could be that. To be gay was to be a normal part of the community, and it wasn't to be ostracized in the way that in larger society it was. You could actually be yourself in whole.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, we, with the whole idea of like mainstream ballroom becoming mainstream, like we still do see a lot of like racism persisting regardless. How do we think that the non-Black queer people have worked to create the community space that has been fought for in like heteronormative society? When we say heteronormative society, we mean that like the society in general is talked about it, where heterosexuality is the default, right? So can you speak a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So I was actually talking to somebody about this, about how a lot of queer, like really big queer movements have dissipated a bit now mm-hmm. that like in North America, marriage equality has been won, right?
Right.
So a lot of like cis, like queer people were like, oh, I can get married now. That's all good. Now everything is okay and we're all fine. And it's like, no, that's actually not real. And a lot of queer people are like, I've like read and I've seen, are kind of like disappointed in the fact that a lot of people were fighting for this, because it does benefit like Black queer people, Black trans people in general. But there are still a whole bunch of other fights that still need to be protested for, that still need to be funded, that still need to have bodies there to advocate for them, especially if you sit in a place of privilege, because sadly, people in privilege will listen to other people in privilege.
Right.
But there's just been this like, oh no, we're okay. Like the gender issue is too much now. Okay. Like race isn't that big of a deal. We're all queer. And that, like mentality has become really like divisive, in the sense of we have been fighting to get these rights, which do help us, but they mainly help you with your last hurdle. And now we're expecting, you know, the reciprocity of like, hey, you're also going to help us in this fight. And it's just an idea of like, no, I don't really get it. I don't really want to deal with it. You know, I think we're okay. Marriage was like a push far enough, and mm-hmm. it's really hard. So I typically just tell people, I'm like, if you are not a part of like an intersecting identity, like you might be like, you are definitely oppressed because you are queer. Like still in today's society, there are a lot of people who hold homophobic, like very terrible sentiments, but there are like further issues to help that. Because if you help like Black queer people get liberation from the racism in the queer community, you will have stronger allies for the fight that we still have ahead. And the trans people who have been a pillar in this fight, if we like help them in their movements to find liberation, to get freedom from the oppression of the larger society, we will have a stronger community. Mm-hmm. Because it's a big joke online where it's like, yeah, we're gay, but we're not white gays. And it's just like, yeah, we as a community have understood that like they have their own space, which I don't think is actually a bad thing. It's that when we come under the umbrella of being queer, there is a very distinctive, I don't want to be like those queers. And it's like, we can't do that.
Yeah. We
literally can't do that, because oftentimes it's us against a larger society. And that relates back to like Black communities, where that has been an issue a lot of me and my queer friends have faced, where they want you to put Blackness before your queerness, and the queer community wants you to put queerness before your Blackness, and you can't, literally cannot, because those identities affect you in those spaces where I'm fighting for racial liberation, but people are calling me an F word. People mm-hmm. are calling me a queer. People are saying very homophobic things to me. And I want to be a part of this community, but I'm told unless I conform to the more palatable idea of this community, I cannot be a part of this community in full. I can support. They'll take the support. But the things that I want to fight for, the things that will help me and my community are not going to be centered, or I'm not going to get the reciprocal energy that I'm putting in for the general, like a heteronormative idea of Blackness. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to get that reciprocity when it comes to the queer people who are Black. And that's the issue with like non-Black people in the queer community, where it's like, then you go to the queer community and you're facing the same thing, where it's like, I don't really want to deal with the race issue. Can we deal with like the queer issues? Like race isn't even that big of a deal. You can vote. I've heard that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, again, it goes back to the idea of these, like, we could call it like the de facto issues, right? Where, you know, it's something that we just kind of understand to be true, even if it's not written into the way that like a party is thrown, or the way that like a law is written. So like, you know, yes, we might have like same-sex marriage or something like that, but we know that that doesn't necessarily work for everyone. Or we know that, like, you know, you can no longer be discriminated against in the workplace for your sexuality. But you might have a harder time making the argument that you were discriminated against on the grounds of your race and your sexuality. Like, I feel like the laws sort of exist, but exactly like what you were saying, it doesn't deal with like the, I mean, I'm using the word mess. It's not a mess because these issues aren't like messes to be anyway. But it just like, there's a lot that you can't deal with when you just look at this law and you kind of ignore everything else and about it. So
100%. And that's why I really like, and I promote that people listen to Kimberly Crenshaw's speech on intersectionality, because the mm-hmm. example she used really opened my eyes to it. Because I'm like, oh, maybe I can just like straddle the line and just, you know, go down two roads at the same time. And she's like, in this factory, there was the employer said they weren't discriminating against people because they were hiring Black people, but they would hire Black men for the labor in the factories and they would hire white women for the secretarial roles. So when a Black woman applied, she was denied because there was no space for her. And it's like, but I am both Black and a woman. And it's like, mm-hmm. no. We hire white women specifically for this area and Black men specifically for that area. And there's no space for you here. And you're literally sitting at the intersections of a road trying to go down two roads at the same time.
Right. And with, so Kimberly Crenshaw, for those who don't know too, she was a lawyer. She was like a legal activist. She also did a lot of work with just like championing like Black rights. And she coined that term. She invented the term intersectionality, right? Like that was her thing. Because there was a thing where the Black women who were applying for these positions, they ended up trying to file a lawsuit as well. Mm-hmm. And I think at the time, you could either file a lawsuit on race-based discrimination or on gender-based discrimination, but you could not file it on both grounds. So they had to choose, right?
Exactly. And technically, the employer is right on both grounds, so you have nothing to fight on.
Yeah. I mean, even when we talk about things like affirmative action has kind of been proven that it mostly benefits white women. So again, it goes back to the idea that, like, you know, we have these laws that are meant to benefit people who are oppressed, othered, and kept out of things like job markets, et cetera, but they don't end up actually doing the work of benefiting everyone. They benefit a very particular kind of person.
Yeah, and it's like the idea of hierarchies. I've been saying this for a long time, but it becomes more like prevalent as I go through life. But a lot of people just don't want to be on the bottom of the hierarchy that they're on the bottom of. The hierarchies that they have privilege in, they would like to keep. They would like to keep them sustained. But the hierarchies that they don't have privilege in, they would like to abolish it. So from a lot of white women, I hear like, I want to be in the C-suite. I want to be the CEO. I want to be able to do like exactly the same thing white men do. And it's like, okay, but like, Black women and like BIPOC women can't, like Black Indigenous people of color cannot do the things you can already do. And it's like, okay, but like that's your issue. We need to focus on the fact that I, as a white woman, can't do what white men do. And it's like, yeah, see, so you like the hierarchy of whiteness. That's fine with you. Mm-hmm. It's the hierarchy of sex that is an issue for you. And I found the same thing in like the Black community, where a lot of Black men, they actually don't mind patriarchy. Patriarchy is completely fine to them. They enjoy it. But racism is where we really need to dismantle that hierarchy. And I try to tell people, I'm like, whenever you want to maintain a hierarchy, you validate all the other hierarchies. Like, you're not going to get what you think you're going to get. So right. If you validate the hierarchy of patriarchy, you validate the hierarchy of whiteness, you are validating the hierarchy of sexism and racism. Because why do we need to get rid of this? Why is this one okay, but that mm-hmm. one isn't?
Because they all come from the same place and they all kind of work to benefit the same person that happens to be the most, we've used this word a few times, the most normative person, the default. And we know the default whenever we're thinking about laws, whenever we're thinking about how people navigate the world, we're thinking about like the white, straight, cis, male, yeah, generally. And if you're not that, then like, then everything becomes a lot harder. And the more sort of oppressed identities that kind of make up you as a person, the more difficult those things are to navigate to.
Exactly. And with affirmative action, you can see where it's like they do want to help oppressed people, or at least the law wants to, but they will help the person that is closest to normativity, who yeah. is dealing with oppression.
And then it's about making these little adjustments, like we'll do this first and then we'll help you over here. Like we'll do the most normative version, and then we'll slowly work over time at expanding things, rather than just trying to, you know, keep it as inclusive as possible right off the get-go. So
yeah. And it's just like, I don't 100% like the term where it's like all tides lift all ships, but if you do help the most disadvantaged, the most oppressed person, everybody benefits in the end. Like, if you help Black trans women find liberation and humanity, women who have been dehumanized by sexism will gain their humanity. Like Black mm-hmm. people who have been oppressed due to racism will gain their humanity. And Black trans women will gain their humanity. Like,
right.
It's a hard sell for some people, sadly.
It's a hard sell, but a necessary one all the same, yeah. Obviously. So. Awesome. Well, I think that is the end of our little conversation today. Thank you so much for joining Teen Health Source. If you want to go and learn a little bit more about the work that Teach does, you can check us out on Planned Parenthood Toronto's website. It's ppt.on.ca, and kind of go through the navigation steps, book a workshop, talk to Paula, learn a little bit more about homophobia, transphobia, and how those things affect us. And yeah, keep an eye out for our next episode, which will be some point later in the month as well.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. Is there anything else that you wanted to add just before we bring things to a little close?
No, I say search up some Black queer media, search up some mutual aid funds, and definitely listen to a podcast or two or read a book this month. I recommend it.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, thank you. We'll throw in a bunch of different resources, maybe some definitions and an explanation in the actual post of this podcast too. So if anything feels a little bit confusing for folks, obviously they can just read the post or actually reach out to one of our peer educators as well. Otherwise, have a lovely Black History Month. Hope you do some learning.
Yeah. Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.